Mostly sunny, a high of 78. Tomorrow night, cloudy skies, a low of 59. For Sunday, partly sunny, a slight chance of some showers and storms during the afternoon. Not much change in temperature. Sunday's high right around 77. Currently 62. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up.
Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg.
We're going to be talking for the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show about the intersection of the U.S. presidency and baseball, America's semi-official pastime. And baseball and U.S. presidents have been tied together in lots of exciting and interesting ways. And I'm very excited to be able to speak with Kurt Smith, a much-admired author of a number of different books, including most notably a book that I've read and loved called Voices of the Game, which basically chronicled the colorful history of baseball broadcasting. His other books include Pull Up a Chair, The Vin Scully Story, Mercy, A Celebration of Fenway Park Centennial, and actually most recently George H.W. Bush, Character at the Core. Among other items on Mr. Smith's interesting resume is the fact that he was a former presidential speechwriter. Hence his very important interest in American presidents. And in matters of fact, George H.W. Bush is one of the presidents we get to know in the pages of this intriguing book. It's published by the University of Nebraska Press. And Kurt Smith, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Well, Greg, thank you very much. Great to be with you.
So tell our listeners a little bit about your own connection to the great game of baseball and why it has figured so prominently in your own life and also has been such an important professional interest of yours.
Well, Greg, thanks very much. It's great to be with you, and I appreciate the invite. To follow baseball, which was the sport of choice in the mid and latter part of the 20th century, you had to do so if you grew up like I did, in a small town in upstate New York, which was not at all dissimilar to small towns across the length and breadth of Wisconsin. You had to do so through radio and television. And it was my privilege to hear some of the great voices of the game, particularly on radio. And they were in many cases more riveting and arresting than being at the ballpark itself. Mel Allen and Red Barber, if you lived in Wisconsin, it would have been Earl Gillespie and Blaine Walsh. And this was enormously fascinating to me and romantic to me, because that's where the poetry of the game is stirred. And so this really, I think, fueled my interest in baseball. And it was an enormous reading game as well, so that contributed, I think, to my love of the game. But this, beyond that, is really the American game, just as the presidency is America's office. And so I think the two institutions together were of great fixation to me. And I remember my mother talking about how I would go to the front porch of the small town in which I was raised and read the World Book Encyclopedia for hours on end. And I would turn to the biographical entries of baseball Ted Williams and Willie Mays and Henry Aaron, and to the biographical entries of the presidency, whether it be John F. Kennedy or Dwight Eisenhower or Washington and Lincoln. And I think together I was enamored of the two. But why would that be a surprise? These were the two institutions that originated here. They were ours. They were born in America. No other country can lay claim to them. And I think, they fused in my mind. And I think they have fused in the minds of tens of millions of Americans. And so the only surprise to me is not that I wrote this book, but that it took me so long to do it. And I can only say that I was preoccupied with other projects, some of which you've mentioned. But finally, I got around to do it, and I'm glad I did.
I think a lot of people are glad that you did. And by the way, you and I share something in common. Not that we're both presidential speech writers, certainly, or best-selling authors, but I read myself to sleep with the World Book Encyclopedia night after night after night after night. And to whatever extent I am kind of a Renaissance person who knows a little bit about a whole lot of things, it's mostly thanks to the World Book Encyclopedia. So that's music to my ears to hear you talking about that.
What a staple of mid-America.
Absolutely.
Right? Not so mid-America.
Absolutely, yes. For sure. One of the things that's intriguing about the book is what a monumental undertaking it was to really properly research it. And certainly right off the bat, and I'm kind of glad that you're acknowledgments are at the front of the book instead of the back of the book, you really spell out the lengths to which you went to really explore this topic as thoroughly as you do. Just give our listeners at least a sketch of all of the places you went, all of the different archives you explored, and all of the help you got to make this book what it is.
Well, you mentioned in your introduction that one of the books I had written was Voices of the Game. And when I wrote Voices of the Game, I lived in Washington, and the Library of Congress was my second home. Here, having returned to upstate New York, where I teach English at the University of Rochester, it was a different beast altogether. Thank goodness for Google. Google was my second home. But in addition to that, yes, you're quite right. I traversed much of the United States in terms of visiting presidential libraries. There are now 13 of them. Barack Obama's will make 14 when it opens in, I think, 2020 or 2021. And they were of invaluable help to me. The Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum was, of course, just an extended member of my family. And thank goodness that lies 3.5 hours down the road, down the New York State Thruway to me. And that has been, my goodness, how do I even begin to express my appreciation to it? It has been my silent partner in the majority of the books that I have done. And its cadre of research is magnificent. So those were some of the research assistants. There are others that I name. And I hope I haven't forgotten anyone, but this took me 3 years at least to write. I described it as my Moby Dick, and I was Ahab, and Moby Dick was ahead on point for most of those 3 years. I hope I resurfaced at the end, but this is a balancing act for me, because Ronald Reagan once told me that if you give anyone in a book or a speech or a magazine article or anything of that ilk, and you give someone 15 facts and one story, and the story is told well, it's the story people remember. Well, he's right. And yet, for a book like this, you simply can't depend on anecdote or story, as essential as they are, but you have to have the supporting cast of one fact after another. And this is where the acknowledgments really play an invaluable part. So I tried to be as complete as I can, and as I was, hopefully, in the acknowledgments, but I'm sure I forgot some. Hopefully not too many. I haven't heard from anyone yet, but if I have, I apologize in advance.
Right. Well, it's a big, thick, generous listing in those acknowledgments, and it gives us a sense of how many people were of assistance to you and of how hard you worked to put this book together.
I could not have done it without them, yes.
Yeah. The first chapter of the book actually explores all of this before the kind of the crucial moment during the term of William Howard Taft when baseball really takes center stage in terms of our U.S. presidents. But I'm really glad that this first chapter is here because it reminds us, for one thing, that if we really trace the history of baseball way back, we're actually talking about certain games back in Revolutionary War days and in the days of John Adams that resemble baseball but not aren't quite baseball before the something that more closely resembles the modern game finally appears. Just give us a little sketch of what I'm talking about and why you included this in your book.
Right. Well, in an amorphous, nebulous sense, baseball actually begins before the birth of the Republic. Back to Valley Forge in that horrid winter of 1777-78, when George Washington, not yet President General Washington, had nowhere to go because the British had us on the ropes. And he was playing a British antecedent of the game called Rounders. They stayed to camp for hours because he was mentally strategizing about what came next. But he had company. John Adams was playing Rounders or other British forerunners of the game. And the founding fathers, without realizing it, had a debt to pay from the mother country in that sense. So it was all a family affair. And we have a debt to pay to Great Britain in this area, as we do in so many. And so ultimately and incrementally, the roots of the game were planted. And ultimately, as the Republic became the United States of America, and our presidents gave way to perhaps the greatest of all, the 16th President, Lincoln, I have a number of anecdotes about how he became the Republican nominee. He learned about it while he was playing town ball in Springfield, Illinois. And there is a story which I believe to be true about how he was playing a game, and a GOP delegation came from Chicago from the convention in 1860 to tell him that he had been designated as the Republican nominee, and he said, well, that's delightful news, but you will have to wait a minute until I have my next time at bat. Truly, this is a man of clairvoyant vision and priorities even then. And then within the next year, of course, he becomes president, and he began playing town ball games outside of the White House on the White Lot, which today we know as the Ellipse. He also took the game inside, where he used the corridors of the White House, in essence, as Bates Pass. We don't know if it was 90 feet from his home plate to first base. We do know that he caught quite a dashing figure, all 6 feet 4 inches of him, as he was gallivanting through the halls of the White House playing ball. And so it was that decade after decade, baseball became known as our national pastime. And this preceded the guts of the book, if you would, which is the separate chapter on each president, really beginning with Theodore Roosevelt and dating through Donald Trump. Theodore Roosevelt, 1901 through 1909, a man that we associate with charging up San Juan Hill and sending the American White Fleet around the world and forging a militaristic foreign policy, but who in fact was scared to death by the popularity of baseball.
Hmm. We really learn a lot here, and I think for those of us who have some interest in U.S. presidents, it's especially fun to have some time spent with presidents who tend not to be all that well remembered. For instance, William Howard Taft, in some respects, he's one of the, well, I was gonna say, one of the biggest figures in your book, and that's true in a couple of different ways, isn't it?
But in every sense of the term. Let me incidentally have a couple sentences on Theodore Roosevelt. What I mean by that was he hated baseball. He hated it because it had no violence, no gore, no death. Entirely too mollycoddle, in his phrase. The kicker was, however, for him, the game was so spectacularly popular, he could not utter a syllable of his contempt for the game. So it quite literally was the only thing in his life that defeated him. He was succeeded by William Howard Taft, all 300 pounds of him. So he quite literally, as you suggest, was a big act to follow. And he inaugurated on April 10th of 1910, the right, which has become an American ritual, and should be for any president, and that is inaugurating the birth of spring, really, and the beginning of any baseball season by throwing out the first pitch.
And you use the word maniacal, actually, at one point in this chapter in describing how much President Taft loved the game of baseball, such a striking contrast to his predecessor.
Yes, well, I use the term with affection, of course. He, but no, Taft loved the game. And in the 1880s, he'd been an amateur pitcher, and his goal in life, his mission, really, was to become a big league pitcher. He failed miserably. Instead, he settled for being president. But he commenced the ritual throwing out the first pitch. He became the first and thus far only president to see a big league game in each major league, the National and the American, on the same date, in the same city, St. Louis in 1910, the Cardinals and the Browns. In 1962, the Sporting News, the then Bible of baseball, named him the top fan among all United States presidents. I suspect now we would have a recount, but he won then in a romp. And he absolutely paved the way. He really did institutionalize, if you would, the kinship, the what I call the twinning of the heart between these two great institutions.
I want to be sure that we take a couple of minutes to talk about the significance of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And I think the fact that you titled the chapter about FDR and the way you do as essentially the president who saved American baseball during a time when there were a lot of other forces that were sort of barreling on it says a lot about how important he was in terms of this presidential connection to the game. Explain to our listeners what prompts you to talk about Roosevelt in these terms.
Well, as mentioned, I'm a former speechwriter for Bush 41, and it's been my fortune to speak at the Baseball Hall of Fame, at the Nixon and Bush 41 presidential libraries. But several weeks ago, I had the enormous privilege to speak at the Franklin Roosevelt Presidential Library and Museum at Hyde Park. And to me, this was an almost religious trek, because Franklin Roosevelt saved America, or helped to at least, economically in the 1930s. With Winston Churchill, he unarguably, indisputably, saved the free world in the Second World War. And of slightly less import, he saved baseball in World War II. Which is why he graces the cover of The Presidents in the Past Time, The History of Baseball and the White House. After the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, baseball, not atypically, was clueless. What did it do now? Did it close up shop? Ultimately, more than 250 of its best players were drafted. DiMaggio, Ted Williams, Johnny Pesky, Yul Blackwell, they trooped abroad or stayed at home, but they were unavailable to play. So what did the game do? Did it close up, out of business, never to return? What? Kennesaw Mountain Landis, the commissioner, wrote FDR a letter asking for guidance. The very next day, January 15th of 1942, FDR answered. And he read his letter in its entirety at a White House press conference, which shows you the import of baseball to the land. FDR not simply gently insisted, or suggested, rather, he insisted that baseball be played for the duration of the war until total victory would be secured. His reasoning was thus, that it would buoy the morale of the home front, the wives and the workers and the children of the land, but moreover, that it would buoy, elevate, if you would, the morale of the troops in the European and the Pacific theaters. And he was right. Surveys later showed that except for letters from loved ones to troops abroad, nothing more elevated the morale of troops abroad fighting than box scores and game accounts in newspapers that those troops received.
Incredible.
So FDR knew the game, and he knew his country.
Right, and he knew where baseball was in the hearts of so many Americans and did not want it.
Which is why I suggest in this book that FDR be inducted posthumously into the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum at Cooperstown. I was there to speak a couple weeks ago, as I mentioned. 317 plaques at Cooperstown honoring players and executives and other noteworthies. Not one of them includes the phrase, save baseball. Franklin Roosevelt saved baseball.
Fascinating. And, of course, in your book we can explore all the other presidents who follow him, and some very, very intriguing stories are part of this. But let's finish in the last minute or two by giving you a chance to weigh in on our current president and his rather turbulent relationship with Major League Baseball. What do you think about some of the choices that President Donald Trump has made?
Well, people, our readers and listeners, are surprised and indeed stunned to find out that Donald Trump was weaned on Maris and Mantle and the Yankees teams of the 60s. And then he went to play baseball himself for the New York Military Academy, a prep school north of New York City, and was a terrific player. In fact, so good that the Phillies and my team, the Boston Red Sox, wanted to sign him. He had no speed, but was very strong, a pull hitter from the right side of the plate. And this was before the baseball draft, the era of bonus babies. And Trump, though, it wasn't enough for him, the money. He said, I didn't want to make baseball money. I wanted to make, quote-unquote, real money. And real money he went on to make. But the fact is he could have been a Major League Baseball player. And he loved the game, and I'm sure loves it still. He threw out, before becoming president, the first pitch at Yankee Stadium, at Fenway Park, and at Wrigley Field. However, he has failed to make a guest appearance in his first two opening dates as president at Nationals Park in Washington. I can only surmise it is because he is leery of being booed by the crowd, which would be predominantly, I am sure, Democratic at Nationals Park. That's only a supposition, but it's the only guess that makes sense. He should make an appearance. It's an American ritual. He's president of all the people. I think he would win points from doing so, from people even that dislike him. He owes it to the game. He owes it to his office. He owes it to himself.
Hmm. Well, much more intriguing information is in this book called The Presidents and the Pastime, The History of Baseball and the White House, published by University of Nebraska Press, a thoroughly researched book, and it includes some great photographs as well. And the author, Kurt Smith. Kurt Smith, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your very interesting book. I appreciate it.
Greg, you've been very kind. Thank you.
And the time is 8:32. You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. And here is part two out of the Morning Show archives.
I remember with great fondness a past interview which I did with an author by the name of S.C. Gwynn. He and I spoke about a really marvelous book of his called Empire of the Summer Moon, Quanah Parker and the Rise and Fall of the Comanches, the Most Powerful Indian Tribe in American History. When I saw that S.C. Gwynn had written something else that and that I had the opportunity to interview him, I was very, very excited. But then quite surprised to see what this newest book was titled. His newest book is called The Perfect Pass, American Genius and the Reinvention of Football. So a book nothing like that first book with which I first encountered Mr. Gwynn. This book, however, turns out to be quite interesting, every bit as interesting as that first book, especially if you are interested in the game of football and wonder how certain aspects of football have risen and fallen in prominence over the years. And in particular, the place of the forward pass, which once upon a time was all but unheard of in the playing of football. And now it is, in a sense, a staple of the game, but not always so. It turns out that one of the unsung heroes when it comes to the forward pass rising in prominence in football is a coach by the name of Hal Mumme. And this is a story about him and about the really difficult road that a lot of football coaches face, far more difficult than most of us ever realize. And it's also about what it means to be a visionary with a game as often tradition-bound as football can be. Once again, the name of this book is The Perfect Pass, American Genius and the Reinvention of Football, published by Scribner. and its author, S.C. Gwynn. S.C. Gwynn, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, it's great to be with you again.
I'm glad we can do this. Tell us a little bit about your own connection to the game of football and what that has to do with the writing of this book.
Well, I'm just a good old-fashioned fan. You know, I was my hero when I was a kid was Johnny Unitas from Baltimore Colts. And, you know, when I moved to Austin, Texas 20 years ago, I just totally got into the Big 12 conference. And, you know, I'm not one of these completely kind of crazy fans, you know, who flies into different cities to do the fantasy draft and things like that. But I'm pretty much just a fan. And the book came from I went out to do an article about a coach named Mike Leach for Texas Tech back in 2009, who had the hottest offense in America. His quarterbacks had led the NCAA 5 times out of 6 years or something, and nobody could stop this offense. And I just asked him where it came from, and he said, I got to tell you a story about this coach named Hal Mumme in a little tiny school called Iowa Wesleyan back in the 1980s. And that turned out to have actually transformed the game of football.
Hmm. And you say in the kind of the acknowledgement section of the book that as you learned about this coach that nobody had heard of named Hal Mumme, that one of the best things about his intriguing story was its very obscurity. I mean, here is this great story just waiting to be told by somebody like you.
True, and even today, you know, I mean, how many people really have heard of Hal Mumme? Inside the football world, coaches, commentators, former players, he is pretty well known. But to the average rank-and-file football fan, he's not. And, you know, if you go back to there he is at this school in Iowa in 1989, a school with 450 students, you know, possibly the worst football team in America when he takes it over. You know, absolutely, it's complete obscurity. And so when he and his assistant coach Mike Leach are driving around in the off season through the frozen wastes of the Midwest, looking, you know, going to see people and looking for the secret of the forward pass, I just thought that just sounds like a great story.
And I don't remember where it is in the book, but at one point you characterize Hal Mumme as a genius who irreverently destroyed and recreated the game of football. And that's a really interesting way to think about it, about somebody coming along and, in a sense, destroying the game, not permanently or irreparably, of course. But what is behind that choice of words?
So if you look at this, it's a game of football, and okay, it's offense that we're talking about here. But in fact, it's, you know, it's the product of all sorts of systems and ways of thinking about things. And you can really think of Hal, I do anyway, in the same way that you might think of one of those innovators like, or some of those innovators like Jobs and Wozniak, you know, inventing the Apple computer, or Hewlett and Packard, or people tinkering and being innovative and ingenious with, and indeed what they then do, their creations then do create enormous disruptive damage to traditional systems. You know, if you look at what Hal's offense has done to football today, I mean, you turn on the TV and you're going to see some quarterback throwing the ball 49 times a game for 500 yards and 5 touchdowns. That's his offense. That didn't exist when he started. So it was, he wreaked havoc on defenses all over the country, and he did it by doing things that no one had done before.
Hmm. So describe to our listeners where the book begins. I think it's quite effective. The first chapter is called The Mad Pirate's Revenge, and It's kind of interesting the way in which you just sort of plunge us into the new reality of football before then, in a sense, kind of explaining where this reality came from. So describe the dramatic game that is at the heart of this chapter.
Okay, so the book starts with 1 minute and 23 seconds to go in November of 2008. And the game being played is Texas Tech, which is sixth ranked, had never been ranked that high before, or not recently anyway, and against University of Texas, number one ranked team, the best quarterback in the country at that point, Colt McCoy. And what I then describe is this incredible air raid offense that, you know, people were starting to get used to, but it had only seen for a few years. that has this ability to, you know, throw the ball 50 or 60 times and put up ungodly numbers of points and yardage on everybody and no one could stop it. Well, we see this in action in the last minute of the game. And the final, and it's a very famous pass if you live in Texas, the final pass of the game is from Graham Harrell to Michael Crabtree, and a 30-yard pass and tiptoes into the end zone for the victory. And what I try to set up, as you say, is I try to set up, well, here's what this thing looks like. And then we sort of, and indeed, this is now swept through all levels of American football, high school, college in particular, NFL more and more. So I just go back to its origins and say, where did this guy get this idea? How did he implement this system? What was the process actually of transformation? How do you do that?
I think it's very intriguing, and I'm really glad that the second chapter of the book is here, titled A Job You Wouldn't Want. And you begin this chapter by saying, in the annals of the American workplace, there are few jobs as thankless, unforgiving, underpaid, overworked, lacking in security, destructive to marriages, and mercilessly competitive as coaching college football. Yes, there is the warm glow that comes from making an impact on the lives of impressionable young athletes, teaching them the virtues of courage, discipline, teamwork, etc. But for the dewy-eyed idealists and everyone else, the more immediate reality is this. And you go on to describe in really rather brutal detail all of the ways in which this kind of work can be really kind of soul-crushing. I'm so glad that's there because, you know, it flies in the face of what we sometimes hear about, which is of big schools paying their football coaches gigantic sums of money that dwarf the money paid to, for instance, professors at that same university. But that is just one little sliver of the picture. And what you are describing, of course, is the unhappy reality for the vast majority of college football coaches out there. Tell us more about why you think that is such an important point to make in this book.
Well, it is. I mean, it's a tough sport. It's a tough job, you know, and it's high school coaching is really football coaching is a really tough job too, except it lacks this one thing, which is the 24/7, 365 need to recruit all the time. And high schools generally don't do that. They basically take whoever lives in their district into their games. But college coaches, you know, the minute the game ends or the season ends, they're on a bus or a plane somewhere to go recruit. And sitting in the, you know, living rooms of countless players and guidance counselors and parents and trying to convince people to come. It's a hard job. It's also thankless because, as we all know, when the head coach gets fired, what happens to the assistant coaches? They all get fired. And I found myself in this world of, you know, people who often had 12 jobs in 20 years or even more. And it was tough. People moved around a lot. And when you look at someone like Mike Leach, who's now head coach at Washington State, you look at the hardship of those early years when he made $3,000 a year lived in these miserable, broken-down trailers. It is a very hard job to do. And so Hal, in my description of him, he's not only, you know, up against all of tradition of football, trying to build this offense that does mostly passes the ball in a world that only wants to run the ball, but he's also got to deal with just life as a coach, which involves, you know, he gets fired, he gets run out of town. It's a tough deal.
Well, and for him, it is also a reality that involves a wife and young children. So it's not just that he is subjecting himself to this because he loves the game of football so much and so desperately wants to coach it, but in a sense, he is taking along his wife and kids on this very difficult journey.
They're on the ride, and one of the things you hear and I write about is that, you know, when the typical thing happens, which is, you know, Thanksgiving comes around and the team hasn't done well and the head coach gets fired. And then, of course, all the assistant coaches get the news that they've been fired too. And often what happens is, you know, if somebody is able to find a new job somewhere, you know, typically the rules are you show up the next day and your family just has to worry about dealing with the problem itself, you know, or whenever anybody hires a coach, they don't really want to hear that the wife you know, he's got to sell the house or relocate the kids from school. And I just heard this from a bunch of coaches' wives. It's a very interesting world of really, I must say, really dedicated people, super, super dedicated people who run this game.
We're speaking with S.C. Gwynn, talking about his book, The Perfect Pass. And before we talk a little more about what Hal Mumme managed to develop, we should touch on the brief history of the game of football that you spell out. And I think the main reason that this is here is for us to have a better sense of sort of the entrenched reality against which this revolutionary-minded coach named Hal Mumme was going to try to work his innovative ideas. In brief, at least, just sort of describe the way in which football had a certain character right from the start, which, yeah, in a sense, was very inhospitable to the notion of throwing the ball, and particularly in terms of long forward passes.
Yeah, it goes back to the early days of football. I mean, football started with this kind of bloody scrum in the middle of the field that was just unbelievably violent. And the forward pass was introduced in 1906 mainly as a way to save the game. So many people were dying, you know, 18, 20, 30 people dying a year, 150 with serious life-threatening injuries. And so they introduced it. But the problem was that American football always wanted to regress back to that game. And to this day, it's still portions of it want to do that. So even though there were little explosions of offense, you know, Pop Warner in the Carlisle Indian School, or maybe Notre Dame with Newt Rockne a few years, Sammy Baugh at TCU, Norm Van Brocklin in the NFL with the LA Rams, basically football always reverted back to a heavily ground-dominated game. It was a running game. Throwing was something you did on third down, you know, and really, if you look at it, what it finally comes to in the mid-70s is what they call the dead ball era. In 1977, in the NFL, fewer points were scored than at any time since 1942. Fewer passes thrown since the 1950s. It was regressing again, and it was so bad that the NFL changed all the blocking rules to try to save the game again. But this is the era in which this new breed of people, you know, Mouse Davis and the run and shoot, Bill Walsh and the West Coast offense, you know, Hal Mumme, Lavelle Edwards and BYU, these really handful of people that I write about emerge from this kind of dead ball era with these hot new passing offenses.
Right. And I guess part of the point of your book is that some of these innovators are well known to football fans, but somebody like Hal Mumme is not. That is, in a sense, a chapter of this story that was largely untold until your book came along.
Yeah, and there's a lot that's untold in here. I mean, nobody's ever heard of Tiger Ellison. I mean, Tiger Ellison in the 1960s invented a type of offense at a high school in Ohio that uses a lot of the techniques that are the basis for all of the high-powered passing offenses now. And who's ever heard of Tiger Ellison? He had this crazy thing called the Lonesome Polecat. Nobody ever heard of. And yet the techniques, when I go through, you know, his offense was the run and shoot, which actually became very influential. But there's a lot of obscurity here. Very few people really know who Lavelle Edwards is. I mean, they might know his quarterbacks, Jim McMahon, Ty Detmer, Steve Young, but at BYU. But so much of this is rising out of obscurity, and even today, these guys are not household, you know, they're not like Vince Lombardi. Maybe they will be one day, but they're not now.
So in terms of what Hal Mumme came to understand about the game of football and sort of its unrealized potential, I find it really intriguing that it was not just one single moment and a lightning bolt from the sky and suddenly I understand this new way of playing the game of football. You choose to describe it in this particular chapter as a series of four different epiphanies. And
yeah,
and these are epiphanies that unfolded over the course of years. and in different places and in different circumstances. Is this the way he sees it, or is this the way it made sense to you to frame it?
I don't think he ever saw it in terms of the four, although that's what it is. I mean, these came out of interviews with Hal. In fact, that's what it is. So there were four. One of them was really great, by the way. One of them, this guy is just good as a football coach. So he's the age 29, youngest offensive coordinator in the NCAA Division I. He's at University of Texas at El Paso, which is sort of the French Foreign Legion of college football. Terrible team. One of the worst in the game. They were playing against Brigham Young, BYU, who was the defending national champion, that had this super hot passing offense under Lavelle Edwards. And Hal, I think they were favored by 36 points or something like that, BYU was. Hal, because Hal was at UTEP, who was in the same division, he got to study their film. So he studied and studied and studied, and he tried to copy it. No one told him anything. It was like somebody who found a radio on the ground. You know, you pick it up and try to figure out how it works. And during this game, he unleashes BYU's own passing, this is 1985, passing attack against them and beats them in one of the greatest upsets in college football history. And the other shoe dropping there is that BYU is so stunned that this guy has done this to them with their plays that they didn't even teach him. That they invite him up, and for years he spends time at the BYU camps, and he learns their system, which becomes the basis of his system. I mean, there's a lot of, I mean, that's what we talk about when we say these epiphanies. You know, that game was an epiphany, that he could do that to the nation's best football team.
Hmm. One thing that is a little difficult to understand about this story is how there could be various people along the way, like this coach out of Ohio, Glenn Tiger Ellison, who writes a book touting some of these revolutionary notions, a book that eventually Hal Mumme reads and is inspired by, but how these innovative thinkers would appear, and yet their innovations would not, in a sense, lead sort of inevitably to this innovation sort of sweeping over the game. And he's not the only one, of course. But so there are these sort of isolated pockets. But what is different about the story of Hal Mumme from some of those other earlier instances?
I think if I had to say what, that's a really good question. Let's look at Sammy Baugh, Dutch Meyer, coach of TCU in Texas Christian University in the 30s. He had this quarterback named Sammy Baugh, who was maybe the best player who ever lived. And they ran a full spread offense. He ran from a shotgun. They used short ball control passes the way Bill Walsh later did. I mean, it was so far ahead of its time. So you would have thought, man, everybody's going to. But the fact is, hardly anybody did it. And so what was different about Hal? So one of the things that people thought about that offense, or most of these offenses, is that they wouldn't be transferable. Not, you know, they wouldn't be transportable. That they would, you know, that somebody like Baugh couldn't be duplicated, or, you know, a receiver couldn't be duplicated. What Hal did, and this was maybe the biggest part of the revolution, was he designed an offense that could be run at the high school level easily. It was dead simple. The simplicity of the thing is most of the genius. It was just dead. So now you can see all over Texas, we're out of air raid offenses, all summer 7-on-7 air raid camps, the whole state's being swept by it. It's because you can teach it, because it's transferable. You can run it at junior colleges and small colleges, and you can run it anywhere you want to. If a coach reads my book and takes anything from it, I would think he would take the simplicity. This guy designed a game that was really easy and simple for his players, and really complicated and hard for your players.
And it also sounds like a system in which you did not necessarily need a spectacularly gifted quarterback or spectacularly gifted receivers in order for it to be implemented. I mean, you don't have to wait for an Aaron Rodgers to come along.
Exactly, and that's right. I should have said that. That You do not need that. And what it does is it makes, you know, if you look at that great book, Moneyball, written a few years ago, what it was about this guy at Oakland who's got $19 million, and New York Yankees have $190 million. And the problem is, how does the little guy in Oakland beat them? That's the problem. And the solution is how he uses statistics. In this case, Hal has these little guys, and how can they beat the big, strong, fast guys? Well, they can beat it through this system. System that will allow a small quarterback or a receiver that isn't lightning fast to compete. So when you do it right, it levels the playing field, and there's a bit of David Goliath in it, with David and Goliath, which is kind of fun.
Mm-hmm. So a closing question. As we follow the exploits of Hal Mumme, one of the things that we sort of grapple to understand is why he's not more famous than he is. Why, if he ended up being such a brilliant innovator, why, in a sense, at least in the more conventional sense of the words, has his coaching career not been more successful, leading from one triumph to another?
Really, you can see the answer to that question, I think, at Kentucky. So he lights up the world at Iowa Wesleyan at the small college level. Then he goes to Division II, Valdosta State in Georgia, lights up the world, sets all the national records in NCAA D2. He's rewarded with the head coaching job in the SEC at Kentucky, 1997. And he takes his offense, and he beats Alabama and LSU. People said you could not use these video game passing offenses to win in the SEC. Hal did. Okay, now we're at the peak of his career. Unfortunately, what happens to him is he runs into a recruiting scandal at Kentucky. Not his fault. It was one of his coaches was out making cash payments to high school coaches and very bad things. It didn't prevent Hal from having to resign in the middle of it, even though he was 100% exonerated by the NCAA, but that was a year later. And I think you could say in a lot of ways his career took a turn at that point. That it maybe is the main reason why he isn't the coach of the Green Bay Packers right now, or something like that. There were some other problems later on, but Kentucky was really his glory and his undoing, unfortunately for him.
Right, and of course we certainly get a sense through the pages of your book that the world of football, just in general, is not always particularly receptive to the ideas of a revolutionary thinker.
No, and it's also it's a razor-edge job, as we were talking about earlier. I mean, ask, you know, Colin Kaepernick and Les Miles about that, about how quickly things change. You know, Colin Kaepernick at the 49ers he was the second coming last year. Les Miles, a few years ago, was the greatest football genius in the country. They're guys that, you know, they're headed south real fast. So it's a cruel profession, I think. In addition to being, as you say, very unfriendly to people with new ideas who think they're going to throw the ball.
Right. Well, in the meantime, we get to know very much both the man and his intriguing revolutionary ideas, Hal Mumme, in this book, The Perfect Pass, American Genius, and the Reinvention of Football, published by Scribner and the author S.C. Gwynn. S.C. Gwynn, thank you so much for writing this great book and for joining me today on the morning show to talk about it. This has been fun.
Greg, it has been fun. Thank you for such a careful read. It's great to talk to you.
And tomorrow, I should say next week in the morning show, we have some really great interviews scheduled, beginning on Monday with Catherine Gerbner, the author of a fascinating book called Christian Slavery, Conversion and Race in the Protestant Atlantic World. What did slave owners do about their slaves in terms of allowing them or not allowing them to convert to Christianity? What did it mean if one of your own slaves became a Christian? Were you in some way obligated to offer them freedom or treat them differently? It's a very interesting and, of course, also troubling question, which she explores in great detail. On Tuesday, Doug Instanis. He has been at the Racine Theater Guild for 25 years, and we are going to look back at his long career at the Theater Guild and also look ahead to the upcoming season there. Wednesday, we'll preview the newest Pike River Rendezvous sponsored by the Kenosha Public Museum. And we will have Nancy Matthews with us and also Edna Lowe, who is one of the enactors who is part of it. On Thursday, a look at New England Patriots quarterback Tom Brady and his comeback. We'll talk with the author of a book called 12, the untold story of Tom Brady's season of redemption. And on Friday, we'll preview the upcoming Starving Artists Fair in Racine. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. JackandDrea.com. Support also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees, transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information is available about competitive scholarships and admissions at carthage.edu/admissions.